It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A proposed widening project along a 3.5-mile corridor of Interstate 94 in Milwaukee is under investigation by the Federal Highway Administration for a civil rights complaint. We get an update as some opponents of the expansion call on Governor Tony Evers to stop the road project. Call in with a question. You can share your comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cassie Steiner-Bouchat is Senior Campaign Coordinator of the Sierra Club Wisconsin Chapter. Cassie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, lay it out for us. Why does your organization oppose this proposed expansion of I-49 from 6 lanes to 8 lanes through this 3.5-mile stretch?
Yeah, we oppose the expansion of I-94 for a large number of reasons. It's an extremely costly project that would not fix what WSDOT claims, Wisconsin Department of Transportation claims that it will. And right now we're really concerned with how the Department of Transportation is moving forward with this expansion, with the knowledge that it will have discriminatory effects, which violates the Civil Rights Act.
What would be the negative effects to residents along the corridor?
Yeah, that's a fairly long list. Highway expansions add traffic to the road, so they worsen congestion in almost every case, increase greenhouse gas emissions, air pollution, water pollution, they add noise, and they make accessing other parts of the city even more difficult. And then added lanes makes traffic crashes more deadly in most cases. So there's a lot of concerns for health impacts, access, and, you know, impacts to drivers as well.
The State Transportation Department says expanding this stretch would help connect people to jobs. It would allow necessary economic development in the area. What is your response to that reasoning?
Well, there's a lot of people in Milwaukee who need access to jobs, who don't have a vehicle or who share one vehicle for their household. There are a lot of workers who access things through public transportation, and the public transportation funding in the state has just been struggling extremely. And with Milwaukee Public Transit facing a fiscal cliff, there's even more concern about routes being eliminated rather than being added, which is what is really needed for workers to get access to jobs. So, you know, we see that claim as a fallacy because the resources are going to expanding this highway rather than to creating a better transit system. On top of that, adding lanes induces demand. So it's sort of a, if they build it, they will come situation, where almost every case adding a lane will bring more cars to the road. So it won't help connect people. We'll see more traffic congestion.
A follow-up on what you said there, Cassie, about other forms of transportation. Jim in Cedarburg emailed to say if then-Governor Scott Walker had accepted federal funds for rapid rail between Madison and Milwaukee, we wouldn't be having this discussion. What are your thoughts on that type of reaction?
I think that's part of the picture. We are extremely behind in our transportation system, largely because we haven't invested in transit, walking, and biking, including things like high-speed rail. So the connection between cities in Wisconsin is extremely difficult, especially if you don't have a car. So I do think that that is part of the picture. However, even taking the high-speed rail out of the question, expanding this highway does not solve the problems that we have.
Cassie Steiner-Bouchat is with the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club, opposing the expansion of Interstate 94 in Milwaukee. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Cassie, the transportation department says this 3.5 mile stretch is a safety concern due to crash volumes and says the number of crashes approaching the Brewer Stadium on I-94 is 4 times higher than the statewide average. So how should community leaders balance those safety concerns with the concerns that you're saying about the area and the corridor of people who live around it?
Yeah, adding lanes in general makes crashes more deadly. So while we may see fewer number of crashes, the crashes that are likely to happen should this be expanded would likely be more deadly. And so it's a question of, what type of safety are we talking about? And then, of course, when you take into consideration the safety of roads that could use transit walking or biking improvement and the impact on public health, you know, safety can be understood in a much bigger way than how it's currently being defined. But in general, adding more, cars are the least safe form of transportation that you can take. And so adding more car infrastructure does not fix safety concerns.
Examining the civil rights aspect here, can you give us a status update on the complaint and the role of the federal government here?
Yes, we filed, Sierra Club and a number of our partners, around 30 people, 30 organizations, filed a complaint with the Federal Highway Administration about concerns over this project. Since then, Wisconsin Department of Transportation released a greenhouse gas emission analysis that confirms that the 8-lane expansion will have more greenhouse gas emissions than a 6-lane alternative would. And so the next steps are for the Federal Highway Administration Office of Civil Rights to conduct an investigation. We are waiting to see what happens, and we're calling on both the Federal Highway Administration and Governor Evers and DOT Secretary Thompson to pause the project while it's undergoing investigation.
Why is the Sierra Club taking on this particular project versus other ones that could have harmful environmental effects?
This is a precedent-setting issue that's been a concern for more than a decade. The scale of this project and the size of the impact, especially on Black and Hispanic neighborhoods around the highway, make it an exceptionally bad case of a highway expansion. So in general, we are not supportive of adding lanes to highways, especially when it impacts neighborhoods, water runoff, air pollution, local parks. But this particular expansion is so costly and so egregious that it's a big precedent that shows where our state's priorities are.
Cassie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Cassie Steiner-Boucha is Senior Campaign Coordinator of the Sierra Club Wisconsin Chapter. And we continue this conversation ahead with a UW-Milwaukee urban planner examining how highway systems can affect urban neighborhoods. And you can call in with a question, share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A proposal to widen a portion of Interstate 94 in Milwaukee to 8 lanes is under review by the federal government in connection to a civil rights complaint. We explore how marginalized communities may be harmed in building out highways. And you can join the conversation, call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kirk Harris is an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee in the Department of Urban Planning, specializing in racial and economic inequities and ways to address the systemic challenges those issues present. Kirk, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
You just heard this argument from the Wisconsin chapter of the Sierra Club opposing this proposed expansion of I-94. What are your initial thoughts on their views?
Well, you know, highway construction has been historically a mechanism for reinforcing many of the systemic disadvantages that we've seen. It's been kind of the infrastructure. We have a legal infrastructure that has kind of created this. And then we have physical infrastructures that have created these challenges for Black and brown and low-income communities. Highways is just one example of how they have segregated communities, is also having negative environmental impacts in terms of the influences on those communities. And one of the challenges, I think, when we think about the role of highways, we have to think about how, as from a planning vantage point, we consider land uses, because what we've seen is we've de-densified our kind of our metropolitan space. Many of the opportunities, instead of residing in close proximity to large population, populations, are now spread out into more suburban areas, requiring transportation through what folks feel is necessary in terms of highways. But really, what we're doing is we're exacerbating a situation, which is there's growing inequality that's being experienced by those communities. They're further removed from the opportunities because they're locked in the city. And we're spending huge amounts of resources on highways as opposed to public transportations. And this is important because there's growing economic inequality in America, and the ability to afford a car is becoming increasingly out of reach for many individuals. And as a result, our decisions to invest in roads as opposed to investing in public transportation further exacerbates those inequalities.
Well, take us back into history here. In the 1950s and 60s, 56 is the Federal Aid Highway Act authorizing the construction of 41,000 miles of highways connecting, right, the country's major cities. And this is coming at a time when there is efforts for housing integration. There's redlining going on, people being kept out of white neighborhoods. How were people displaced during this time? And what is that ripple effect of, racial segregation in our landscape?
Well, as a lawyer, I have to begin by saying we have a legal infrastructure that has created this challenge. In the early, part of the 20th century, we had Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, creating the first residential segregation ordinance. We then had the Supreme Court upholding separate but equal status with respect to segregation. We had the Village of Euclid case that reinforced the ability of communities to exclude. And we've had the public practices and the private practices associated with restrictive covenants, all of which have contributed to this infrastructure of disadvantage and privilege, quite frankly. And now what we're dealing with is as we looked at the mid, around the 1940s, we began to see kind of these shifts from urban to suburban, fueled by governmental policy to suburbanize America. And that suburbanization process, which facilitated the migration out of large white populations, also created the isolation of communities of color in the city. That further exacerbated situations related to opportunities, and highways, which were a part of this process, facilitated the movement of those populations from what was then the urban core to the suburban fringe, facilitated by housing policy that the federal government allowed to exist for purposes of supporting the migration of those of white populations out of the city, but not allowing those same benefits to inure to black populations in the city. So what we had was highways actually facilitating and kind of augmenting the public policies related to housing, which then created this suburbanized frame. And then the highways themselves actually began to deconstruct black communities, because in the period of urban renewal, where people began to see, look at all this decline that's happening in cities, we have to do something about it. And the what they did about it was essentially, in many instances, created development patterns that actually use highways to cut through black communities, which in many cases decimated those communities, never to return, and further segregating them, maybe not legally anymore, but segregating them physically. And so there's a long and unfortunate, storied history of the ways in which highways have kind of exacerbated the inequalities that we see in America.
Thank you for saying that history and making those connections. Kirk Harris is here, associate professor at UW-Milwaukee, as we discuss infrastructure and the ways communities are affected. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Rich in Rhinelander is here. Rich, hi.
Hi. Thanks to Kathy Busch and Kirk Harris for bringing this public. As a person who's currently shopping for new cars, I simply want to point out that private transportation, which is highway transportation, is based on the idea that the individual investor in a car is willing to start spending around $30,000, $36,000, $40,000 or above on a car. Wisconsin needs a transportation policy that is across the board for all the citizens. And it is a state that still has a minimum wage of $7.25 per hour. I want to thank the two guests that you have on today. And I also want to say I totally dislike Scott Walker's
Rich, I just want to jump in here and allow Kirk to respond there in terms of both, you know, how access to vehicles and the cost, and as well as, you know, the people who can get behind the wheel and afford to go one place with one person in the car.
Yeah, well, let me just say, I think what's raised, thank you for raising that. I think what that suggests is, again, you know, if we look at our society, America is one of the most unequal societies in the industrialized world. If you look at the levels of inequality in America, what you'll see is the fact that, as you've pointed out, the wage rates and the opportunities for individuals to generate income has not kept pace with the costs of living in America. And that has had major impacts on certain populations, largely black and brown populations, low-income populations, who need alternatives to cars because, as you pointed out, cars are expensive to secure. But there's another thing about cars. They're very expensive to support in terms of insurance and gas and maintenance and all those things that once you're a car owner, you have to essentially support. So if you're looking at these larger patterns of inequality and you're asking the question, what are some of the solutions to that? Cars may not be the solution. But I should also say, obviously, we need to also rethink the way we're doing development in the region. Why are things so spread out? Why aren't we thinking about the ways in which our land uses, i.e. around development and housing and retail and all that, why isn't that not closely coordinated with our public transportation system? Why is that not the case? And I think that's a systemic problem. And then we disinvest in public transportation, which further exacerbates the situation of inequality.
And you then also have the role of the urban planner who is trying to navigate this and create these walkable environments. And yet you have these also these huge highway systems, these trenches through communities.
That's exactly correct. And let me just say, I appreciate you mentioning urban planners, but we as urban planners have also historically been complicit in the design and the placement of highways. So we're now dealing with that, particularly as we take a much more progressive and thoughtful and democratic view of what a healthy community, what communities should have in order for them to be healthy, whether they're low income or communities of color. And so now we're dealing with the fallout of the planning practices that have happened over decades. Many of the highways, for example, have decimated communities that were actually well functioning.
And I want to just jump in right there. Kirk Harris, associate professor at UW-Milwaukee in the Department of Urban Planning, call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're at the intersection of our nation's highway design and racism over generations. As a proposed Interstate 94 expansion in Milwaukee is under a civil rights review by the Federal Highway Administration, call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Kirk Harris with us, associate professor in UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning. You have a talk about Interstate 43 that runs through Milwaukee presented to the Community Transportation Academy and how that highway has destroyed Milwaukee's Black community. Can you explain what's happened?
Well, this is part of the larger historic picture of how highways get constructed. And largely, those highways get constructed because we see opportunities to grow economic opportunities for certain communities and not for others. The other real significant challenge that we have is when we, and I'm going to continue to emphasize this as a planner, is that we often, in considering the ways in which economic development happens, we don't fairly consider the full scope of communities that are going to be impacted. And we don't often, in our highway development, understand the history that's behind it. A lot of that highway development that has kind of impacted communities negatively is a function of the urban development period. And that urban development period has driven a lack of understanding about the ways in which the highways have run through communities, and largely because the choices that have been placed on those highway selections have not been equitably considered. And so when you look at the highway example that you're talking about now, the question is always, you know, in America, the question always is, who's bearing the benefits and who's bearing the burdens of the strategies that we're invoking? And that's always the question when we're looking at the highway development scenario, because historically the benefits and burdens have not been equally distributed, and Black communities and Brown communities have been most impacted by those choices.
Specifically, eminent domain. Let's touch on that, the government's ability to take private property for a public purpose, and the people displaced by Interstate 43 that occurred, are they paid or compensated for this displacement? What happens?
It's a really, eminent domain is an interesting phenomena, because it's a powerful force for government to kind of realign ownership, right? Because what they essentially do is they secure property for purposes of development in many instances. And what the research has suggested about eminent domain is that eminent domain has not worked to the advantage of low income and communities of color, largely because they don't often possess the political power to resist what government may be invoking for purposes of advancing a particular objective, whether it be economic development, highway development, and the like. And the problem with it is that many of the individuals that are impacted by eminent domain often aren't owners. So typically in an eminent domain situation, what happens is if you're an owner, if you're a homeowner or a property owner, and you're affected by this eminent domain initiative, you're compensated at some level. Now, one might argue, many of the owners argue they're not sufficiently compensated, but you're compensated for that. For those who are not owners, who are simply renters, there is no compensation, and there often is large amounts of displacement. Businesses are displaced, homes are displaced, et cetera. So, and it has historically been shown that the largest impacts of those displacements have happened in Black, brown, and low-income communities.
And the fabric of your neighborhood is shattered, right? I mean,
It's totally shattered. And the problem is that often with the displacement strategies, people are further isolated in communities where they might be displaced to, which are not often worse than where they were. And the social connections that may have existed amongst those communities are totally deconstructed and destroyed, as you pointed out.
so fast forward to the infrastructure law, President Biden earmarking $4 billion to reconnect communities that were previously cut off from economic opportunities by transportation infrastructure, like we've been talking about. What is your take on this initiative?
Well, I think it's important. I think it's important for the federal government to take heed about many of the consequences of what federal policy and national policy has generated. So now we have an infrastructure that physically, in many instances, separates communities. We have now have to rethink what that means, because many of the communities, when we think about that, in America, we're one of the we're as a United States, we are more segregated today than we were in 1954 when the Supreme Court outlawed segregation. So the question would becomes, what's responsible for that? And what's responsible for that is many of our practices related to highways, many of our practices related to housing, many of our practices related to economic development. And so if we're going to overcome that, we're going to have to be very clear-eyed and very deliberate about the deconstruction of many of these systems that reproduce segregation.
Because
And so,
you're trying to rectify historical inequities that have gone on for generations unheeded.
and they become systemic, right? And
Mm-hmm.
sometimes what happens is that our when we look at these things, they're so present and they're so deeply embedded, they become normalized, and we no longer have close examination of what's transpiring. And I think that I give credit to the Biden administration for pointing these things out, but I also means that there's going to be it has to be enormous amounts of effort and resources in order to kind of turn around a circumstance that has been generated over decades.
Kirk Harris with us, associate professor in urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, as we look at the historical effects of these highway systems. And you can call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jill in Madison is here. Jill, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to share?
I just thought it was an interesting perspective change that I kind of underwent when I was working for a nonprofit that was dealing with a lot of advocacy and promotion, and even just education around bike use and infrastructure, walking school programs and whatnot. But I think it's really interesting to think about from a perspective of how much we are paying and how much we are building for the storage of personal property. Every parking spot that is on a street is just to store somebody's box, which is the moving box of a car when it's not in use. And there is just so much that has to be maintained. So many resources that go into that. And again, also just the land use and how much we are investing just to be able to have cars sitting around, versus having public transportation is essentially always eternally moving. We are paying a lot, and we are using a lot of resources and space, for just the housing of cars.
Jill, thank you. Kirk, what comes up for you on storage?
Well, let me just say, I think that really does speak to what we're prioritizing in terms of our built environment. And the fact is that we're always thinking about how we're housing cars, because we never think about the ways in which we can totally advance public transportation and fund it in a way. Over the holidays, I took a trip to Europe. And one of the things that was really interesting, it was never a problem getting a bus. Everything was walkable, and it was just a seamless process. And I think we have to re-engineer the ways in which we think about placemaking as it relates to our transportation options. And I do think that we have built infrastructure associated with cars that we continue to feed that monster. And by the way, many of the individuals who are struggling economically with the issues of being able to capture opportunities in the region and can't get to them are taxpayers themselves. And many of those taxpayer dollars that should be more equally distributed for purposes of transportation for those types of individuals is not being sufficiently considered. And so, again, you know, why is that? And why is it that we're so committed to not, our highways and not supporting public transportation in a way that would both lower the carbon footprint and also open up opportunities for individuals to navigate the region?
Let's bring in Dwayne now in Westfield. Dwayne, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Longtime listener, love the show. The question I got is this: as long as we've always had roads that roads have been around, things have always been, sometimes people get gypped if it's like they want to put a highway near a certain spot and they take away from a little town. Now, I grew up there, born and raised. I've seen the city change a lot. But unfortunately, sometimes when they make changes, other places kind of lose the financial burden of what they were getting before, and it's hard to make up. But the question I got is, how are they going to make that up? It's basically, you can't. It hasn't changed in years.
When it's embedded in how the infrastructure was built in the first place, how do you make those changes, Kirk?
Well, I think that's a matter of public policy and practice. I think we have to be intentional around the ways in which we reinvest and things that we haven't reinvested in. I think we need to rethink about the ways in which we bring housing and economic development and green space together to generate a more dense living environment, so places are much more walkable and much more accessible and potentially more affordable. I do think that we have in our minds that, that the car is king. And if we can re-engineer the ways in which we think about the opportunities to generate public transportation and support it, I think we'd be far better off both economically, far better off environmentally, and we'd be addressing in the long run these larger inequalities that kind of continue to manifest as a result of the public policies and practices that we continue to push forward.
Kirk Harris on the faculty of UW-Milwaukee's Department of Urban Planning, studying racial and economic inequities, the practices. Call in with the question, add your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With a federal civil rights complaint underway of an I-94 expansion proposal in Milwaukee, we explore the racial effects of the interstate highway system, the urban communities in Wisconsin and beyond that are affected. Call in with a question, share in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kirk Harris is here, Associate Professor of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. Kirk, with a federal civil rights review underway of this proposal for I-94 in Milwaukee, how effective in general are civil rights reviews in response to transportation complaints?
Well, you know, as a lawyer, let me just say it like this. Part of the problem that I'm challenged with is that these civil rights reviews are really important, and they really do speak to the environmental justice concerns that should be lifted up, in which they talk about the benefits and burdens that may be experienced in terms of communities. But the problem here is that often, in some instances, those assessments don't lead to strategic kind of efforts to address the problems that are so deeply embedded in the infrastructure development itself. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is that, first of all, we do these assessments for purposes of ensuring equality in the development of this infrastructure. But the reality is the resources that are required to actually address these deeply embedded challenges aren't actually often made available once these things are uncovered. There's challenges within, you know, environmental impacts on communities. There may be continued problems with the fact that communities still aren't able to access opportunities in the region. But those larger systemic problems aren't often effectively addressed after those assessments are taken under consideration. And the other challenge is that for many communities, particularly communities that are finding these as problems, and they have to actually assert their interest and rights, and that places the burden on the community to actually require them to litigate in order to get something addressed that is a bit more systemic, right? So you create the problem, you identify it, there's not enough resources to solve it. You may push forward with the project, then it requires communities that are most burdened to actually identify an advocacy opportunity to try to address the problem more holistically. So I think the system is really, as a recovering lawyer, I won't say rigged, but maybe I will say rigged. It's not functional for the individuals who are being impacted by it on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, and in putting the onus on people who bear the burden to prove that a transportation system is having such an impact, is causing harm, I wonder, going earlier into the process of planning, that takes, you know, years and years for some of these projects.
Right.
How could, racial equity impact studies or, even racial equity statements affect these government agencies and these decision makers in the highway development process way up the pipeline?
Well, this is a really good question. And you know what the answer to that is? Public engagement. But you know what? Public engagement is expensive, it's timely, and there's a disinclination to be involved in it, largely because what you often are going to hear is people speaking to that history that has compromised their communities, speaking to the issues, and many of the individuals who may be invoking these highway strategies from a top-down basis may not want to necessarily hear all that. And so the answer to it actually is democratizing the process, but the challenge is that that process is often resistant to that democratization. So that's the dilemma, right? That we have in the planning context, is because we know we should be hearing those voices. Those voices will inform us about the ways in which they're impacted and some of the things that need to be addressed. But are we willing to kind of resource that understanding, and are we truly willing to fold it in to the decision making?
Let's go to Jason in Janesville now. Jason, hi. What would you like to say?
Yes, I have a couple questions. What do you say, first of all, what do you say about this not being a racial problem as opposed to a socioeconomic issue, as opposed to those being forced to rent? And two, those who are forced are those who own a home being forced out of their home due to the tax burden for the highway cost on their house, and as well as the equity versus equality issue. Doesn't that breed more of a racial disdain than as equity as opposed to equality? If I could hear your response. Thank you.
Well, I think, you know, there is a distinction between equity. Equity understands the existing historical conditions which place individuals into a particular circumstance. Equality just says give everybody the same thing. And partly the challenge is that we recognize that there's been lots of history that has constructed disadvantage in a way that has to be addressed. So that's the ways in which I make the distinction between kind of equity and equality. But let me just say, I think there is a close nexus between economic and racial issues in America. If you look across the spectrum in terms of wealth, for example, in distinctions between communities of color and non-communities of color, you'll see that there are big distinctions in that. Yes, with respect to development, many communities are impacted, and gentrification is a major issue that often not only impacts low-income communities, it can also impact, you know, middle-income homeowners. It can, in fact, raise their taxes. But these are the things that we in planning need to be able to contemplate as a function of our development process. We have to be comprehensive in understanding what are the impacts. And if we're not doing that as effectively as we can, we will see them result in ways that we should have anticipated.
Kirk, you are in the early stages of establishing a center on equity practice and planning justice. What is the goal?
The goal is that, as I said earlier in the show, you know, we live in a society that is more segregated now than it was in 1954 when the Supreme Court outlawed segregation. And we know a great deal. You know, we as academics like studying stuff. We like telling what the problem is. And my belief is that now, after all the studies and all that we know about why America is segregated, we need to be really specific about how we address it. And we need to be talking about mitigation and deconstruction of segregation and what practices, policies, and approaches and initiatives need to be brought forward in order to do that. And so let's move. The center is focused on moving from what we know theoretically to what we should be doing as planners and community builders and placemakers, what we should be doing strategically and from a practice vantage point.
In our final seconds together, what is your message to urban planners, briefly?
Well, my message to urban planners and my message to everybody is that if we're going to see democratic placemaking, if we're going to create healthy, secure places, we're going to have to deconstruct all of the systems that have actually created the segregation that malapportions opportunities and resources to communities. And if we don't get at that problem, we're going to be having the same discussion when they throw me in the grave and throw dirt on me. And that's what I don't want to see.
Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate your time.
Kirk Harris is an associate professor of urban planning in UW-Milwaukee's School of Architecture and Urban Planning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.